Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. As always, thanks for joining us on this Sunday morning. Coming up on today's program, we've got a report from our occasional series, Culture Couch, and a conversation with Eric Van Vlieman, Executive Director of the Miami Valley Alzheimer's Association. We'll catch you up on all the latest updates there. Up first, on August 14th, 18-year-old Abby Alexander, a Miamisburg native now living in Cambodia, was traveling on a motorcycle with a fellow teacher. The pair were seriously injured when the petrol station they were riding past exploded, engulfing the two in a massive fireball. Other riders and bystanders were also injured. By late Thursday or early Friday, Abby was taken aboard a medical transport plane that was to bring her back to a medical facility in Denver. She was expected to arrive there on Saturday morning. Abby still has family in the Miami Valley, and her aunt, Kathy Wurzbowski of Springboro, was kind enough to speak with us about how her niece is doing. We sat down to talk outside a coffee shop in Centerville. Your niece, Abby, is going through a very difficult time right now, and I don't know much about the government structures there and health and safety. What was the local reaction to this explosion and to Abby's care at the start?
So definitely sympathetic. My brother and his family have traveled all over the world, and so last year they decided they were moving to Cambodia. They found the people were engaging and accepting, and people were very concerned right away. They have a community of expats, but also the locals were very concerned. My brother and his family, they have never met a stranger, so even only living there 8 months, they knew a lot of people in the community really came together for them. They were able to get Abby transported to the capital city where she could get adequate care. The hospital staff has been amazing to my brother and my sister-in-law and Abby's fiance, but she's at the point where she really needs to have further care. And so that's why it was so important that they get her to the States in a time frame where they can do the skin grafts effectively and get her overall treatment.
And her exact condition is she was burned 70% of her body?
Actually, I believe it was 39% was the number. And so, unfortunately, she doesn't have enough of her own skin to graft. So I believe they're looking at synthetic. So they'll know more once they get to Denver.
And my understanding from other media reports is that as they were riding the motorbike, they smelled gas and the explosion occurred. So that leads me to believe she is communicating.
I think initially they were able to get some details out of her, but then, of course, once the breathing tube went in, and along with that, due to the nature of her injuries, they can't spend a tremendous amount of time with her. And the time spent, the physicians have been very clear that it needs to be on a positive note to avoid her getting emotional and making her situation worse. So I'm sure as she gets better, she may want to talk about the details, but...
And her fellow teacher is in much the same position, or how are they?
Yeah, so it's my understanding they had similar injuries, and she, Zoe, the other woman, is in Bangkok undergoing similar parallel treatment, so...
The flight back to the U.S. has been a little bit of an issue, but I understand that's underway. Can you tell me, say anything about the challenges that were brought up with having to bring Abby back to the United States?
So what I can say is that you rarely hear about when something goes right with the government. With our government and the Cambodian government. And I think this was a case where constituents got a hold of representatives. The representatives listened, and they were able to help facilitate Abby getting out of Cambodia and getting the care she needs in Denver. So my brother is very grateful, not only to the plane service, of course, but also to the State Department and how quickly they were able to sort of rally behind them and make it possible for her to get home. And they are very complimentary of their embassy agent as well. So she's been very helpful. They had help from the U.S. Embassy right away.
Abby was teaching, and she teaches young children in Cambodia?
Yes, yeah, so she teaches preschool and pre-K, and I think kindergarten as well. And it's something that she enjoys. And so being from afar and watching her posts and her videos, and the kids just adore her, and she adores them naturally. And she was definitely coming into her own, and it showed moving to Cambodia. She grew a lot and she matured, and I have enjoyed watching her blossom into this just amazing young woman. And I look forward to watching her, you know, for as long as I get.
So you mentioned before Colorado, your brother and his family were from the Dayton area, correct?
Yes, they lived in Miamisburg up until about 6 years ago when they made the decision to move to Denver. And so our kids grew up together, and we spent all kinds of time together. And Abby and her brother, Tony, they've always been so dear to me and always will be dear to me. And I'm glad you asked that question, because right now there's a lot of stories about the explosion and about, you know, the aftermath of that. And Abby herself, it will always be a part of her, but it doesn't define who she is. She is this witty, funny, genuine girl who has the most distinct giggle. And I will be out in Denver next week to visit, and I'm hoping I get to hear that giggle. But she is so charismatic, and this is unfortunate, but Abby was bound for big, good things before this, and I know that she'll pull it off still.
You said your brother and his family, they never met a stranger, and my understanding is that they like to teach, they like to volunteer, they like to be involved, and someone mentioned that quite often it's people who put themselves out there like that are at risk for just all kinds of things happening. So it seems like if any family could move through something like this, your family would be one of them.
Oh, absolutely. And Aaron, my brother and my sister-in-law, they've always wanted their kids to know how big the world is. And so they started traveling from a fairly young age and exposing them to different cultures and different ways of life. And I do not see them or the rest of the family changing those values and those beliefs. And this was truly, you know, an accident where I can't imagine ill intentions were at play, but an accident, and perhaps, you know, from lack of regulations. But no, I don't see them changing their lifestyle or their philosophies at all.
Kathy, we wish certainly the best for Abby and her recovery and safe return to the U.S., and the best to you and your family as well.
Thank you.
Kathy Wierzbowski of Springboro talking about her niece, Abby Alexander. You can link to Abby's story online at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us. This is WYSO Weekend. Each year in the U.S., around 500,000 people die from Alzheimer's disease. 5.8 million currently live with it. Those stats paint a dire picture of the illness and its destructive impact on society. But for people who have made Alzheimer's prevention, research, and treatment a part of their mission, there is hope in the wake of new developments on those fronts. To find out more about all this, we spoke with Eric Van Vlieman, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association Miami Valley Chapter. Eric begins by telling us the changes in Alzheimer's research in the 18 years he's been in that position.
The Alzheimer's Association has three core things that we're trying to accomplish in our mission. One is eliminating this disease. If you've ever been affected, you know it's a really bad disease, and not only impacts the person, but the whole family. And so we're doing everything we can to eliminate it. We're also working to serve more people. And whatever we can do to help people with information, support, education, we're working to do that. And the third one is brain health, and happy to talk more about that. But as we've learned more about research and about the brain, there's a lot we can do to keep it healthy. And so we're working to improve brain health in America. So over 18 years, you know, when I started 18 years ago, a couple of things. One, we never talked to a person with Alzheimer's. We only talked to the family. And one of the big things that's happened is with people being diagnosed a little bit earlier, we now have programs for people with the disease. Two is the research funding when I came was $300-400 million. It was that way every year. We'd go to Capitol Hill and we'd fight and, you know, raise our voices, but nothing happened. And we took some new approaches about 7-8 years ago, had several laws passed that required Congress to get a report every year of what needs to happen to end this. We had a National Alzheimer's Plan passed and requiring the federal government to put a plan together what they're going to do. And since then, we have watched research grow from about $400 million to about $2.4 billion. That, and we'll talk more about that, I'm sure, when we're talking about research, but that is increasing the hope because, you know, we know people who survived with cancer. We know people who've had heart condition and survived, and that's because we've invested in research to make that happen, and now we believe that it's Alzheimer's turn.
You briefly mentioned nutrition in there as one of the aspects of this issue, and I believe the National Institute on Aging has allowed plenty of additional funding to go toward this area of research.
Yeah, they are researching it as well as the Alzheimer's Association is investing our own dollars. It's our largest ever private investment, and it's called the Pointer Study, and it's basically studying lifestyle factors. So one of the things that we learned in July at the research conference is that lifestyle factors, healthy eating, keeping your brain active, exercise, and those kind of things are really important. What we found is when you do them together, they're even far more effective in helping to stave off dementia. And so the Pointer Study is being sponsored by the Alzheimer's Association, actually directly funded, and it is taking those areas as well as cardiovascular risk action, doing things to make sure you're cardiovascular risk factors are down, and we're testing it basically as a treatment, just like you would a drug. And so this is happening now. We've got 5 sites in America, and you know, as we do this, we will be able to follow. And then unlike other studies that show cause or they show correlation, so they can say, here's all these people and they did this, and this happened, but we can't say it happened because of that. The Pointer Study will actually, it's just like a drug treatment. We have a placebo group, you know, a group that's getting something different, very less, and then we have the treatment group, and they are doing, they're following a healthy eating pattern. There's coaches for each one of these areas, an exercise area. As I said, cardiovascular risk factors, trying to bring that down, blood pressure, blood sugar, keeping those healthy, and as well as brain stimulation and keeping your brain active. And we will know probably in the next couple of years how that data is starting to come out and, you know, if it's actually a proven treatment for Alzheimer's and not just a great suggestion.
Let's talk a little bit more about this conference you attended, I think, in July.
Yeah.
It's a large conference with a lot of expertise gathered together.
Yeah, I never felt so dumb as when I, you know, hung out with 5 or 6,000 of the world's leading researchers on Alzheimer's. You go to these meetings and that you understand about the first paragraph of them talking, and then I zone out for about 30 minutes, and then I listen to the summary. And but these are amazingly passionate people who are spending their lives on very small pieces of science sometimes. And what's exciting when you go, you know, I mentioned the dollars. We have an additional $2 billion. Is because we are doing that, we are now able to get younger researchers in with new ideas. So the things that we've been trying for 20 years, we now have new minds thinking about it. And because with the new dollars, we're able, researchers are like, hey, this is a profitable, or not a profitable, this is an area I can keep my lab open and do science I love, and they gear it towards Alzheimer's. And so we're seeing just so many new ideas to attack this disease. And that's probably one of the most encouraging. And they are so thankful for the dollars, you know, that come in to help them do this kind of science. The other thing is that you see is just the number. I mean, almost 6,000 people from across the world. So this is not just America, all with a united purpose of trying to end this disease and care for more people. And it's really inspiring to see. But a lot of neat things came out of it, too.
Let's talk about what's happening in Ohio and here locally with your organization as well. I understand the Cleveland Clinic and several other health systems in Northeast Ohio have announced they're collaborating to bring Ohio its first dementia research center. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, we've had dementia research going on, but the federal government sponsors what's called Alzheimer's Disease Research Centers. There's about 30-some plus in the United States. So one of them somewhere else in the United States closed down. So basically Cleveland Clinic was able to get the contract to do that. That's really exciting because that group zeroes in and focuses together on trying to do whatever they can to use those federal dollars and the thinking to share ideas of how they can end the disease. And so it's a big win for us in Ohio to have that. There's one in Indianapolis as well and one in Lexington. And so, you know, residents in the Dayton area, but really throughout Ohio now have a lot of great options for that. But there is research actually happening. A lot of people aren't aware. We have several research studies going on right here in Dayton, Ohio, and several neurology practices are leading research for Alzheimer's here. So you don't have to go far away to get it done. But, you know, if you want that second opinion or if, you know, you want to, they might have more research trials, you know, it's worth a drive. But we do have things in Dayton, Ohio going on in Columbus, as well as now there'll be even more in Cleveland, giving more people opportunities when they're diagnosed to do something.
This sounds a little fantastic, but I believe there's research being done on a nasal spray to help improve memory. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, isn't that strange, you know? And every time I think about that, that's an odd way to go about it. But basically, there's research that goes right now around the different causes of Alzheimer's. And one of them is linked to the insulin, how our body accepts insulin in the brain, right? Not just that we're used to thinking about that as diabetes, but how sugar is impacted in your brain. Actually, one of the drugs that we have now deals with that piece of it. So, again, another example of something new beyond what we've been trying. A physician and researchers had an idea that what if we used insulin, but you just can't give somebody insulin because otherwise it throws off their whole insulin system, right? You know, like a diabetic or a healthy person has a regulated system. And so that is why the nasal spray, because then it gets taken up into the brain without impacting the whole body's insulin system. Basically, in a phase two, so there's three phases to like an FDA trial. Phase one is safety. Two is dosage and safety, and their beginning of is this effective, and then three is a pretty large-scale test of whether or not it's effective, and then they can pass this out as a drug. And that's how we get drugs in America. And so basically it's past phase two. So they found that people that use this actually had an improvement in their memory and that it was effective in that. And so, but again, that's on a phase two, so it's a smaller group. And we've had a lot of drugs get through phase two and still fail in phase three once you get a broader number. You know, we always have to be guarded, but we want to share the excitement that new things are being done and novel things. So whereas we've always worked on plaques and tangles, that's the hallmarks of what happens in your brain when you have Alzheimer's disease, you know, because we didn't have a lot of funding, we could only focus on one area. And now, you know, we're able to see these new type of developments come, which is exciting.
With the convention that you attended over the summer and some of this great news on research and funding, you've got to be pretty jazzed about maybe the future of tackling this disease and at least moving the ball forward, if not out and out, finding a cure.
Yeah, and we sat through one session. And basically, it was four different novel approaches. This is outside of the... And I sat there and just thought to myself, these are amazing. And probably what's going to happen is Alzheimer's is not going to be one pill, right? And so if you think about the heart condition, you actually, even if you're taking different blood pressure medicines, a lot of times now they give you a couple different pills and combine them. They start with one. But there's multiple treatments, right? There's treatment around cholesterol. So there's a lot of multiple things that are being done to treat it. And probably Alzheimer's is going to be a similar process. There's not going to be one pill that someone's going to get that's going to cure them. Genetics does impact the effectiveness of some of these treatments. And so what was really exciting, what I was jazzed about, was that we have layers of things that we're trying that more than likely it won't be just one of them. One of them might work and we'll start and get some help, and then maybe the other one will figure something out. And so it's an exciting time. The other area that's exciting, we have brain scans now. So we used to have to wait until a person was fully diseased, and then after they passed away, we would brain scan. And it's a pretty ineffective way to find a treatment. Because of brain scans, we can now see the plaques and tangles. We know that this disease starts. So if your listeners, you know, we think of Alzheimer's, you know, starting in their 60s and 70s. We know it actually starts 20 years before that. And so basically, even in your 40s, probably more likely 50s and 60s, the plaques and tangles we know now are accumulating. And what's exciting about treatment is that because of the brain scans, we're able to test before people have it. We can now use the brain scan, select people who have that going, but they don't have the dementia symptoms that we know of with Alzheimer's. That gives us great hope. And the last thing I would throw in on that is, now that we have the brain scan, so we can see what it looks like, we're able to test blood samples based on that. And the real ultimate here would be to have you go in and see your doctor, and you're tested, and you can see, you know, these plaques and tangles are increasing in your blood, there's indicators in the blood, and that will speed up research. You know, we wouldn't want it right now because there's nothing, you know, there's not a treatment, but we do want that to be developing, because when the treatment comes, it would be pretty difficult to get everybody a PET scan, very expensive. But if we could get it in a blood test, we could get help to the whole population.
Any local initiatives, fundraisers you have coming up, or events that you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, we have our walks. Last year we had almost 5,000 people come out in five different walks, Dayton being the biggest with about 3,000. It's going to be on October 5th. And throughout September, we'll be up in Miami County and Springfield and up in Sydney and in all those communities. It's just a great time. We have this flower ceremony that we do. So people hold up a flower for the reason that they've come. They've lost somebody. They're caring for somebody. They're just supporting it in the community. Or they have the disease. And it's probably one of my highlights of the year, is to watch 3,000 people get quiet, which, you know, doesn't happen anymore. And everybody's holding the flower up. We call them one by one. And then there's just a silence usually. And you got these flowers, if you can imagine, these orange and blue and yellow flowers spinning in the wind. And you look out and you see people tearing. And the message I would love to leave them with that we get at the walk is, you're not alone. There's so many people. There's 30,000 people just in this general area impacted by the disease, 90,000 caregivers. And so that's almost 120,000, which is about 10% of our general area here, who are really right now dealing with this. And so they're not alone. But we ask people to come out, raise money for us. They can sign up at alz.org/walk. And they get their team, they invite their friends. It's a fun Saturday. We do it at, started at 10, everybody's walking by about 10:15, and you can enjoy a great morning, help end Alzheimer's, and then get on with the rest of your beautiful fall day. It's really a wonderful event.
Great. We'll share that link on our website. Eric, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Eric Van Vlieman, Executive Director of the Alzheimer's Association, Miami Valley Chapter. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend. Well, professional baseball is celebrating its 150th anniversary this summer, and the pro game has its roots here in Southwest Ohio. In 1869, the Cincinnati Red Stockings were America's first and only pro team. They toured the country playing amateur clubs. Baseball was different then and tougher. It was played barehanded. There were no gloves, no stadiums, no peanuts and Cracker Jacks. Dayton has what's known as a vintage baseball team called the Carillon Clodbusters. Community Voices producer Jason Reynolds says vintage baseball is a blend of historical reenactment and amateur athletics.
Striker is dead on a manly catch. As you can see, ladies and gentlemen, it pays to catch a ball on the fly.
That's John Everett. He's an attorney, a prosecutor for the city of Kettering. But today, he's serving as a judge, presiding over a vintage baseball game. And judge was the common term for umpire in 1869. Everett is also dressed to the nines, wearing a full suit, top hat, and bow tie, despite the summer heat wave. He's outfitted like this so he can accurately play the part.
And that's what this is. And so a lot of it is the theater. It's learning the language. It's learning the rules and how to interpret them. It's learning the dress, how you would act. So you ready for a little vaudeville?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Everett calls it vaudeville because he has some routines set up with the players. For example, players weren't allowed to spit 150 years ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, I am the moral arbiter of today's match. My job is to make sure there is no spatting upon the ground.
The fine for spatting upon the ground is a quarter and a public apology.
Mr. Wallace, would you please apologize?
I'll do better in the future. I apologize.
He really is a fine gentleman.
The fellow who had to apologize is Mark Willis. He's one of the more experienced players here. This is his 27th year.
Yeah, I came because I liked the sport, but now I've stayed all these years because of the sportsmanship.
Willis says he loves the meals after every game. The home team always provides for the visitors, and win or lose, old friends reconnect. He's also quick to point out what baseball means to American culture, especially how it's been ahead of the curve on integration and understanding.
Look at what Jackie Robinson meant. You look at David Ortiz and the Red Sox after the Boston Marathon bombing. Baseball is part of our DNA. It's part of our history. It's part of everything. And the sport has grown and changed as our nation has, but it's always led us just a little bit.
Other players, like Nate Buckner, feel a very personal connection to the past when they play.
I've played baseball since I'm, 5 or 6 years old. My dad was my coach. So he's no longer with me. He died back in early 2000. So keeping that alive is for his legacy. Yeah, maybe he's looking down from the heavens and, putting a blessing on me.
And that feeling goes for guys on both sides today. Sean O'Mara plays for the 1869 Red Stockings. He's a descendant of Calvin McVay, who hit a home run in the very first pro game.
He's my great-great uncle, so it's an honor to wear this uniform 150 years later.
O'Mara is excited to play for the vintage Red Stockings. They're the only vintage team associated with a current MLB team, and that gives them some perks. They've had a chance to play on the Reds' home field for a demonstration before a major league game, and they've even been sent out to California to play some vintage teams out there, in much the same way the real 1869 Red Stockings toured the country. Back then, the Red Stockings were a bit like the Harlem Globetrotters in basketball. They toured America, beating the pants off amateur clubs in every town. They didn't lose a game that first season. But in 2019, at today's game, the Clodbusters got the best of these vintage Red Stockings. And as the game comes to a close, the players line up and give three cheers to each other and the crowd.
To them, hip hip, huzzah!
Hip hip,
huzzah!
Hip hip,
huzzah!
All right.
This game was played at 10 Wilmington Place, a senior living center in Dayton. And it was a big hit with residents like Vondi Miller.
Oh, I love it. And I like the umpire. And I like that they catch with their hands. Yeah, I had quit following baseball, but I like this.
On the other end of the age spectrum, the Clodbusters also teach vintage baseball to kids who go to summer camp at Carillon Historical Park. That's what they did almost every Friday last month. And one of the campers, Alex, who was in the 8 to 12-year-old camp, granted us an interview between innings.
I want to know what you thought of 1860-style baseball.
It is very weird, but actually very fun.
What's weird about it?
That you have to catch with your hands and it very hurts a lot.
Despite the pain that comes with making what they call a manly catch, Alex says he'd like to play the game again and again. And so, at 150 years of age, baseball seems to be in surprisingly good health. For Culture Couch at WYSO, I'm Jason Reynolds.
Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. Since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you, I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning. Join us then. Up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.